Department. Honourable members, the department is here to present on SRI. And as they present to us, we would like them to tell us as much as possible on SRI, particularly after we've been to the various oversights. So that's what we would like them to tell them. But within a period of about an hour, so that the members that are going to be leaving early will be able to get the whole presentation and to ask questions as well. But I would like to welcome Honorable Makubela Mashele, who has not been well for quite some time. Welcome back, ma'am. We're happy you're back. So I'm not sure whether we've got to introduce each other because we've been a family and a team, but I'm sure maybe it's important to do it. I'm Beatrice Ngobo. I'm chairing this committee. On my left is Jerry Boltina, the secretary of the Portfolio Committee on Tourism, the person you always talk with. On my right is Dr. Sibusiso Kuzwayi, the content advisor. I almost sold him to Kuzwayi, to Hadebe, but it's Sibusiso Kuzwayi. Thank you.
Morning, everyone. My name is Lusizo Makubela Mashele, a member of this portfolio committee coming from Mpumalanga province. Thank you.
Morning, everybody. Morning, Honorable Chair. My name is Manuku Masihela, member of this committee from Limpopo, deployed by the African National Congress. Thank you.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Patricia Adams. I'm from the Northern Cape and I'm employed here by the ANC. Thank you.
Good morning. My name is James Force. I'm the DA spokesperson on tourism.
And a brand new father.
Morning, everyone. Thembala Mxeko is my name. I am a resident of Ward 10, Mvashe Local Municipality in the Eastern Cape under Amatole District Municipality. Thank you.
Morning, everyone. My name is Greg Crumbuck. I represent the Democratic Alliance from KwaZulu-Natal.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Sinuso Sixhaso, Executive Secretary for the Chairperson of this committee.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Pinky Ntuli. I'm the researcher for the committee.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Thabo Makubedu from National Department of Tourism.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Melanie Titus, PLO in the Office of the Minister.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Beatrice van Niekerk. I'm the Parliamentary Liaison Officer in the Office of the Director General.
G and your team.
Good morning, Honorable Chairperson. I probably will have to introduce them to contextualize why they're here. My name is Victor Tarake. I'm employed by the department as the Director General. Murunga Rampili, DDG responsible for domestic tourism. So she's the DDG responsible for EPWP as well. Lerato Matlakala, she is the chief director responsible for SRI. The gentleman next to her, that's Ishmael Akalwaya. You will get more details about their involvement as we do the presentation, but he is the lead project manager from GTEC, which is Government Technical Advisory Center. It's somewhat an entity of treasury, and they are helping us literally to clean up SRI, if I could put it that way. We've got Maditong Kisitwala, I almost said advocate. She is our lawyer. She's here to share with you if you've got any questions about the processes relating to what we are doing with the people that we've taken to the police around the forensics. And Shamila, she is responsible for, in the process that we let me put it this way, in the process that we are embarking upon currently, which is part of the process towards the reorganization overall. She has responsibilities around issues of product design and so on and so forth. So we want her to be here so that she understands some of the issues you would be raising, so that when we integrate those issues going forward, it would actually be taken into account as well. So that's the team that's going to be supporting.
Has joined us. Can you quickly introduce yourself? Then the DG will start giving us the presentation. Thank you.
Thanks, Chair. My name is Tim Kuskawula, representing EFF. Thank you very much.
Honorable Chairperson, thank you very much. We will try to be brief but informative in this presentation. In the interest of ensuring that members are afforded sufficient time to engage with whatever we are putting before the committee this morning. We will speak a little bit about the broader objectives of SRI, how it's funded, a little bit of history in terms of the projects that we've got in our register, what we've been able to achieve, and then we will come to the lessons learned and the challenges that we face with the program, as well as the corrective measures that we are actually putting in place. We'll give you an update in terms of the forensic audits that we conducted and the outcomes of that and the actions that we've taken. We'll also speak to status with regards to projects that still need to be completed, where are we, what still needs to happen, and so on, and we'll give some detail about that, and a little bit of other projects. This will either be destination enhancement projects or projects that deal with skills development. Chairperson, what we have, the department is funding and managing the implementation of tourism infrastructure projects, skills development projects, and destination enhancement projects, and we are doing this through this SRI. And essentially, SRI has to use the EPWP methodology. And broadly, the objective of EPWP, hence the objective of SRI, is job creation, which relates to full-time equivalent jobs. And this is through the provision of either a range of tourism services or the creation of this infrastructure. And some of the things that are done within this context is VISTA information centers, the services around that, accommodation establishments, caravan sites, retail centers for crafts and so on, heritage tourism products, day visit prisons, example would be something like Falls Bay here and so on, youth tourism learnerships, and there's a lot of work that has been done around that, tourism experience and destination enhancement, safety monitors would be a typical example of that, and another range of other products that have actually been dealt with, and now it also goes into a lot more of this experience type, but we will speak a little bit more about that further. There are conditions, and these conditions, amongst others, is the project must have the ability to generate a labor content of 25 to 35% in terms of infrastructure. In the main, I mean, the requirement is that it should actually get to 35%, but this 25%, at some point, there were negotiations that perhaps we could actually get to that. That was a once-off. So there's really a lot more demand on the budget that it should actually go into the wages, it should go into the labor intensity in the context of the whole EPWP methodology. Of course, there are targets also around youth, there are targets around women, there are targets around people with disability. A challenge here, Honorable Chairperson, Honorable Members, is that with people with disability, we have not necessarily been able to meet that when it comes to issues of infrastructure in the main, and that's an area that really has presented a bit of challenge. But the other, in terms of youth and in terms of women, we have far exceeded the normal targets that were stated up front. And of course, we have got to deal with the issues of employment, management of relations and so on, and benefits and so on, in terms of these special public works programs dispensation that the Minister of Labour updates from time to time in terms of what it should look like. And a component of the budget must also go into skills development that are associated with the implementation of the project, and that must be accredited, and that should be up to 5%. Non-accredited also at about 2%. All of this is still just going to the people that would be doing the work. It's not necessarily then going into the actual infrastructure per se. And the infrastructure must be for public benefit. A bit of history around this. 2010, when the department, 2009, the proclamation for establishment of the department came through, and after that, there was a split of the then existing register of all the projects that were in place. 310 files, basically contracts, were handed over to the department, to the newly established department. We've gone through those contracts in a very thorough detail. And when we finished with that, we realized there was a whole host of projects that essentially were already completed and were already handed over and need not necessarily be in the books of the department. We've done that work. We've gone through it with the AG, and we made sure that we actually get into full grip with what do we have in place. And we realized that we actually have 43 projects, and those projects, in total, they've got about 97 contracts. Now, what the difference there is, you would find one project where the building of the lodge is a separate contract from the road that is going inside the lodge, and it's also a different contract from the fencing of the lodge. So those are the types of contracts that would then be associated with this. And the other project, this 267, they are already administratively closed and concluded. Here I would like to give credit to National Treasury in that when they brought in the modified cash accounting mechanism, it allowed for us to be able to actually go asset by asset and identify and be able to document and say, this is what we have been able to do with this money. And that's why we were able to arrive at that figure that we're talking about. Without this, it would have looked like we've got hundreds of projects out there. And why are these projects actually not being taken care of and so on? And those projects are actually not in our hands, and we actually have no say, because some of them are in the hands of communities, some are in the hands of municipalities, some are in the hands of provinces and so on, and we have got absolutely nothing to say about those projects. What we are trying to do, Honorable Chairperson, is to go to the provinces, each individual province. If I'm not mistaken, we are left with one province only at this point in time. We have gone to all the different provinces. I've gone to most of them. I think the only province I was not able to go was one. And in all these particular provinces, we then go through this register that we are talking about. And they lift some of them. I would give an example of a place like Northern Cape, where they were able to actually tell us, we know it is actually at this site. It is working. We know that one, and that one is not necessarily working. And they've got a success rate of, I would say, over 75% in the Northern Cape. But that's not necessarily the picture across the country. There are other provinces that have done better. There are other provinces that have not necessarily done as well. What have we been able to achieve to throughout this particular process? We were able to create 21,933 full-time equivalent jobs. And it is important to state that we retained people for a considerable duration
within the laws, because we can't go beyond certain periods as well. But we are talking about 21,933 jobs that relate to being in the job for a year, excluding holidays and weekends. A lot of assets have been created, and they are in the hands of communities through this particular process. It would be good at some point to actually show a total picture of the success rate, and that is some work that we're still going to go a little bit deeper into. There are some that are working well. There are some that have not succeeded at all. And there are various factors which we are going to talk to as we get to that. Local procurement and supplier empowerment, bricklayers, landscapers, interior deco, and so on, all those kind of things. A lot of people were able to be empowered within that particular context. There's a story in the Northern Cape about people that were assisting in terms of road paving and so on, and providing some material for that, and they got the skills to be able to deal with these things, and they were able subsequently to tender successfully for proper road construction. So there are some spin-offs, good things that also come out of these projects that normally do not necessarily automatically come out. That just indicates the nature of the additional skills that also come with this, that is the type of unaccredited and so on. We also were able to take 2,077 youth as chefs, 6,600 youth. We call them buddies, but this is hospitality training in a various ranging aspects of hospitality. 470 youth, food and wine pairing, wine appreciation, but they can actually go further and actually become sommeliers as well. And these are highly absorbed, because these are people that would actually, as you get to the restaurants, they would then be able to advise you as to which wine would go best with a particular meal that you have actually decided on. These safety monitors, it was quite a very successful project. It was across a couple of provinces, Gauteng, KZN, Western Cape. And this is something that, Honorable Chairperson, I must say, going forward, we're still looking forward to expanding on this, because particularly for peak seasons, it's something that we do believe there is a whole lot of value that we could derive in terms of this particular program. Now, the challenges that we face with this program. We're implementing infrastructure projects, and we're doing it within the context of the environmental cluster of the EPWP. So there will be a tension between the jobs that can be created and the resultant infrastructure in terms of it being delivered within the scheduled time that you envisage. So you end up with infrastructure being developed over a considerably much longer period of time than it would have been. You get the jobs, but as you get the jobs, it means you are also getting a bit of a challenge in that costs here will be escalating, and over a longer duration, you would end up actually spending a lot more than what you would have done if it was within the construction cluster. There were issues, Honorable Chairperson, with regards to viability and due diligence assessment. So you would find that the people that are getting involved in that are the same people that in the end might actually be dealing with the projects themselves in terms of implementation. So those are systemic issues that we've identified. But the question that comes in is, it would be very difficult for someone who's doing a feasibility with an understanding that this is a step towards the next step for myself to say this thing is not necessarily viable as such. So those are some of the systemic elements that we have identified and which we will demonstrate as to how we're going to be dealing with. The detailed technical planning issues, designs, these were completed after the budget has been allocated. So what it does is that you have a figure, but then you're going to do the plan in a way. So you fit your plan to the money And when you fit your plan to the money, in the process it might compromise a whole lot of specific aspects that need to be factored for this thing to actually sustain, which leads to having to come back and say, this element should have been here, but it is not, and that element should have been there, and it is not. So those are some of the systemic issues we've also identified. There was very limited planning amongst all the stakeholders, and this actually has a direct impact in terms of going forward, then the sustainability. So if you work with a community here, and the municipality is not totally involved, with the exception of it being in the IDP, the province is not totally involved within that, it definitely would actually have a whole lot of challenge in terms of actually sustaining it going forward. But it also raises much bigger questions about when you've got someone who would then at the end be running this thing, but is not necessarily involved in its planning from the beginning, it does present a much bigger challenge. And so those are some of the systemic issues we've already identified that are being factored in, but we'll talk about that as we go. And again, there's a decline of EPWP budgets. It's not just within the department. It's something that is across the system. And that decline of these budgets will, of course, have an impact even on how we then conclude some of the ones that we are still going to be looking into that are still outstanding. We have also learned that the majority of community-based organizations that are actually beneficiary organizations in terms of these particular projects, they neither have the capacity nor the capability to operate and or manage the accommodation establishments. And the pre- and the post-construction support, training, mentorship, and so on, that is so needed, but it must actually be that these things are done from the very beginning. And we are saying it would be ideal that if that community, and we say that lodge, we are going to proceed with it, there must be people that are coming from that community that get into our chefs programs that we're talking about, that get into our hospitality programs that we're talking about. But beyond that, that are also taken through a better understanding of hospitality management, so that the sustainability even beyond, so you get this operator to come in, but there must be sustainability beyond the exit point of that particular operator. We have noted also that these projects are capital intensive, way too intensive capital-wise. And in particular, where we are going for greenfields, it's really very, very challenging because we've got to put in bulk infrastructure and so on. And what we are saying as a bigger lesson from that is that that's not our space. We should not get involved in that. We can't be putting in bulk infrastructure. And it should be that the place itself is ready, is viable, and we are able to then go there and say, this is what we're going to do, because it is practical to actually do this thing. And like I said, sustainability mechanisms must actually be put in place from the beginning of the project, and the partners that are going to operate must be sourced as we commence. So these are some of the things that GTEC would have to actually factor in, so that by the time we say we are done, the person who is going to operate this was part of that whole process and knows what done means. This includes things like what the systems for operating will be, the decor, and so on and so forth. So it doesn't become this person here, and the other person comes from the other side and say, now we need to do this, and then you have got to redo a whole lot of things after you have actually almost completed the thing. Joint planning and pulling together of resources across the spheres of government, whether it's horizontal and vertical, this is the most critical success factor, and this is what we're going to be pursuing as well. A typical example would be the projects that we are going to be handing over in the next couple of weeks. These projects, we are bringing on board the provinces to make sure that they oversee these things post the handover process. And that's working together in that partnership is what is going to lead to some of the projects actually sustaining. We have also learned that EPWP requirements would be best served, Honorable Chairperson, by pursuing the types of projects like destination and experience enhancement, and in some instances also maintenance of viable existing facilities. So if it is already there, it exists, it does have visitation and so on. The upkeep of something like that and making sure that it remains in good condition and so on, and it is already in the hands of government, that is something that we believe would actually assist us and would probably also give us a lot more value going forward. And the skills development side of this has also given us the achievement of the actual objectives themselves. We are saying there's a need for an integrated approach, and this approach must take the economic case, if one could put it that way, and the technical aspects associated with getting to achieve that particular economic case. And if we don't go that route, we would end up actually building white elephants. But it should be that investment must be done only in cases where viability has been tested and confirmed. And that is part of their spec in terms of that in-depth economic analysis of each, which means, whilst I'm still there, which means of all the projects that I'm going to talk about that we will still go and evaluate and so on, which they are going to these places, if there is no viability, Honorable Chairperson, we will come and say that particular project, there isn't viability out of the test we've conducted. We will not proceed. And we will be transparent in our reporting and we will demonstrate. And where there is a case, we will definitely make sure that that case is pursued until we have made a success of that. We have also seen that where implementers had a tourism background and we had brought some of the people that are operating from the beginning, the success rate is much higher, much, much higher. And the involvement of all the parties led to most of these sustainable ones. This slide simply demonstrates some of the factors that would assist in this viability. It's not exhaustive at all, but it is just trying to demonstrate the thinking and the approach, the freshness of the approach that we actually, so we are looking at all these things, issues of availability of land, the ownership issues, the land use issues, because we have had lessons from there where you start, and as you have started, there's a claim, and the claimants don't want that particular thing that you're putting on that site. And those are the dynamics that we have really come to grasp with, and we must be able to move forward with better clarity in terms of issues associated with should we do anything here or not. Then we've got issues pertaining to access roads and so on, and we're saying we shouldn't be building roads. It's not what we should be getting. It's okay to build a road that comes from here to connect, and it's an accessible area and so on. The place must be accessible from the very, very, very beginning. It can't be that we have got to find all sorts of other means to access the place. How will the tourist actually then access that particular place? Bulk services, it has to be a primary requirement. We can't start something without that, and we cannot then take money and then put it into these kind of facilities. The identification of beneficiaries, and sometimes the beneficiaries have got to be protected from themselves. Because once you have handed over to a particular community, those communities, what we have learned is that in some instances, they would then get somebody and say, come do this thing here, and decide. Even in some instances, not necessarily taking advice from the department, because they own it. It's theirs now. They can do whatever they want to do with it. So those are the dynamics that we've picked up, and these are the things that we are tightening as we're actually going forward. So I'm not going to go through all these, but issues like market viability, that is very, very critical, but also the surrounding attractions and amenities. What is the tourism case for the area that we are going to put that thing. It would be a sad case when something is going to a place where I myself would not want to go because there's nothing else to see in the area. So those are the kind of things that we are actually taking into account. Corrective measures. We are now, Honorable Chairperson, applying stringently the construction industry standards within the context of EPWP and SRI. So what does this mean? It means that we take cognizance of the rates, changes and so on, and in terms of being able to say what would make completion of this particular project from the day one to that particular day that you envisage to finish. Then you take into account by what percentage is likely to actually increase based on the trend of what they have published before, and so on and so forth. We are providing support in pursuit of sustainability, and we started off by trying to see if financial support would assist, and we realized it cannot sustain. We moved on to get partnerships with an operator, but as you get that partnership with operator, now we are saying provinces also come on board. We a few weeks back, Osmrunga went to one of the products in Limpopo that has already been handed over, but recently handed over, and discussed with the community, brought in the province, and made sure that the province would then look after this community in terms of their interests being taken care of as this operator comes on board. So it's that kind of approach we're doing. I had similar discussions last week or early this week. We are handing over one project this weekend. I'll talk about it later. But Gauteng now is on board to make sure that sustainability of that and integration of that particular product into their broader offering in the province is actually taken into account. But I will talk a little bit more about that. We have introduced this milestone payment system. This is a bit of a challenging one, Honorable Chairperson. The requirements from the EPWP side is such that we need to get companies, smaller companies, you know, that are starting and so on and so forth, that don't necessarily have the kind of cash flow to carry projects of the magnitude. So what happens is that you've got to actually do an advance payment to conclude the planning. When they finish the planning, then you will do advance payment to do phase one of the construction, finish that next phase, and so on. So all we have to do here is to make sure that our controls are tight. And that is why GTEC would actually also be going on site. So you would have a report that comes to us, that comes from the implementer, received by our officials, but our officials will test that with the technicians that are actually coming from GTEC to say, yes, we have seen this on site and it is exactly what they are saying. You can sign the payment of the next trench so that we can move to the next stage. So those are some of the things that we are making sure that we tighten the system. But we are not in that professional space. And the bulk of the things that are done here are done by professionals, engineers and so on. So that's why we need that that technical expertise. We are also doing a full review of the funding and the prioritization thereof, which is why I've spoken about a few elements of the new direction we're taking in terms of the enhancement of the destinations and so on. We took a decision, Honorable Chairperson, after the forensics. And I will explain to you when I get to the forensics what we found. We took a decision that we are not putting more money into this until we have properly evaluated. A typical example, we had one site which the work was done duly, properly, everything was good. the implementer and the, what do you call these people, the beneficiaries. They interacted. The beneficiary kept issuing instructions of what they want, change that, no, do this, do that. And the implementer was going on with this without coming to us. To a point where he realizes this is at a point where I cannot proceed because I will not be able to proceed. And that's when they come back to us and say, I've hit a snag. What do I do? So it's things like that, and that's why we need the eyes right there on the ground and make sure that things are signed off and inspected properly by professionals on site. GTEC, they are here. If there are any questions for them, they would also be able to provide responses. I've also sourced external auditors, Honorable Chairperson and Honorable Members. Now, they are reviewing our internal systems, practices, relationships, all those kind of things, so that we really, as GTEC comes back and say, we've done this, and you can finish this, and this is what you need, and so on and so forth, we're able to actually support it adequately on the other side, from a financial side, with in-depth understanding of some of the gaps that need to be closed, whether they are legal, whether they are financial, whether they are policy, and so on. Those things we would actually deal with. But once those have been identified, we will also take this and put it into the GTEC design so that it actually takes into account those particular issues. And we are continuing with our engagements with provinces so that we are making sure that as we hand over, those things are actually not just left out there. I will not necessarily go into the details of GTEC because they are here, they can answer some of these questions, but they are actually going to be able to give us a project support office that would enable us to deal with all those things that I was talking about. Forensics. Honorable Chairperson and Honorable Members, 2010, we had four projects that we referred to the investigators. We got recommendations. And after those recommendations, three of those projects, we took the cases to the police, and one was taken on arbitration. The SAPS then referred the cases to the Commercial Crimes Unit. NPA initiated prosecution in one of the cases, and it went to the Commercial Crimes Court, and that case has not yet been fully concluded as such. The lawyer can give you a lot more details with regards to the issues around the arbitration and so on. But what we are doing with this case and the next cases, which were the 13 projects that we referred in 2013, we have taken these cases to the police. The police, after they'd gone through the Commercial Crimes Unit and to the NPA, indicated that their decision was not necessarily to prosecute, but rather we should go the civil proceedings route. And that then kicked into the system that we have got to deal with this through the state law advisors. And our intentions here, Honorable Chairperson, are quite clear. What we want is we are asking for a recovery of the total expenditure. And we are leaving it to the people that have got the responsibility to say, hang on, I actually earned this duly. You can't ask for this, which is okay, then we then go for the rest. And we know that these are companies. Companies do liquidate and so on and so forth. And as such, our view is that instead of just leaving it like that, we would then have to go as far as taking the names of those that would have actually been found on the other side of the law to the blacklist within the National Treasury. And we'll do that in personal capacity, not in company's capacity, because that would actually be inconsequential, so that at least the message does go through. So those are some of the remedies that we are foreseeing from this particular process. These processes, Honorable Chairperson, they do take some time to actually come to conclusion. But we are resolute that we are actually going to be pursuing this till we actually get to the ultimate end of it. So what were the findings of these forensics? We had possible misstatements, that's what the report says, of expenditure on the material that was used and the equipment of this project. And this is from the implementer's side. We also had cases of non-compliance with pertinent conditions of the agreements by both the project implementers as well as some officials of the department. There was also issues of inaccurate reporting or failure to report on progress of the projects by the project implementers and the provincial project managers. All this says there was weak project management capacity. And there were also elements that had not necessarily something to do with project management, but that when one looks at that, this is why we took some of these cases straight to the police. When misstatement is there and one says, no, I actually spent 100,000 instead of 50,000, which is the actual, that now borders on fraud and so on. And this is why we had taken these cases for prosecution and so on. So what we have done internally, we have taken these cases through disciplinary processes. We have concluded those disciplinary processes. Some of the people that were implicated are not longer with the department and so on. But what is important here, and this is where this is the pain, I would say, of every accounting officer, Chairperson. We accounting officers, once the process has concluded in terms of disciplinary process, and the presiding officer at that particular disciplinary hearing has pronounced on a sanction, the responsibility of the accounting officer is to administer the sanction as is. So whatever my own wishes may be and so on, I have to adhere to how things should be done. So all these people ended up with their written warnings and so on. Others have left, like I said. But the most important thing is that action has actually been taken, either through the criminal justice system, the civil cases and so on, or the disciplinary cases in terms of labor-related matters. All those were actually exhausted. This is just some of the risks that we've identified and how we are actually dealing with those risks. I'm not going to dwell on this, but I will actually just indicate one very critical thing, that for this particular duration, which is this particular period, the delegations, financial delegations associated with this program are with the accounting officer. And this is to allow us to be able to get this whole system redesigned that we're actually going through and get this GTEC process done. And once it is done, then we're able to gain delegations with particular conditions where applicable to the relevant officials that then should be able to sign off for certain things. These were the projects that were actually affected there across a number of provinces. But these are the projects that were actually affected by these forensics. And they are being reviewed, so they will visit each of these project sites and be able to actually conclude which one and how and so on. With the exception of the first one, that LP Chakuma Heritage and so on, these abbreviations are for the provinces. Now, this particular project, some assets were bought. The assets that were bought, because the beneficiaries nonetheless were going to be the same communities, we have then given those to the communities. But looking at the project and looking at the site and what the fact that not much had been done on that site, and the time that has lapsed since, I think this was a 2010 project or so, it warranted that we actually take a decision. And the decision that we took was to actually go and engage with the community. So we sat with the chiefs and we discussed it with the chiefs, with the community and so on, and we came to a conclusion that it is not viable to actually proceed with the project. And it was an understanding community that actually accepted that under the circumstances, and they know about the cases, they are witnesses in some of these cases because they are people that were party to the implementation of the project and so on. So that project we have actually written off it's not going to be proceeding. The assets that were accrued, that we have already disposed of those assets back to that particular community, and we have closed this particular chapter. Of course, it's not something that we rejoice in, because the original intention was to actually empower this particular community. But because of unscrupulous conduct in the process of implementation of this, it has led to that community actually suffering this detriment. So these are the kind of things that we are looking into. The evaluation of the rest of this particular project that is going to be done by GTEC would then tell us which one we are proceeding with, which one we are not proceeding with. Two critical things. One, economic case, and technical viability as well. Those are the two conditions that we're going to look into. We are going to be launching projects, and we have launched others within this stretch of 2 months. So in Free State, we did this lodge, Vesitsuk. It's a great project. I would recommend that honorable members, having said all the things that I've said, this is worth visiting. Gauteng, Kom Jeke Jeke, this is the project I was talking about that we've got an agreement with the Gauteng Heritage Resources Agency to be able to get this into the pool of the heritage resources that are part of the Gauteng product, but also it is within the Dinokeng precinct, which allows it to actually then become an integral part of that. So we will actually be having some good continuity in terms of getting it well done there. And then we've got the Milberg Information Center, as well as this Kaikari, which has already been launched. I'm told Vetsitsuk is going to be launched on the 19th of November. Kom Jeke Jeke is going to be launched tomorrow. The King is also coming, of Amandebele. And Middleburg, when is it? On the 18th. So there's a whole process of actually getting these things. You can hold on to the slides that you've got. I just want to show you these products. This is Vesisuk. It's a fantastic facility. It's a beautiful facility. It has got very good occupancy rates. And it's a place to visit. And I think it is something that members, time allowing, is worth to actually go. It's got a good operator also, and it is also in the network of the products that are in this transfrontier type. So a couple of ingredients to get it right. This is Kom Jeke Jeke, just to show what it is and what. This is inside the Middleburg Information Center. It's working. It's in business, and it's so there are some things that worked well, very well. There are some things that went very wrong as well. This is a caravan site. There's nobody here because this picture was taken in winter, so nobody would be. It's still closed to date. Okay. So the feedback you've got. I think I would also like to go there to see what would be the issue. But we have got Northern Cape on board on this one as well. They're actually, we've spoken to Drini in acting capacity, so they're also going to provide support. These are the projects that are currently under implementation. Alual Spa, the Remembrance Garden for Credoc. So there's a whole host of projects that we are busy with currently and so on. That's still the list of those projects that we are busy with. The list continues, and these are projects under planning. So the projects that are under planning, GTEC is also going to go for these ones and look at strengthening the case where the case is viable and make sure that we are actually successful in this regard. So I'm not going to go through any of them in detail, but I'm just listing them there so that members can see them. These are some of the current initiatives. We, Honorable Chairperson, we are unlikely going to meet the FTE targets for this year. And for a real reason that we are in a year of cleaning up this thing. And we were going to meet these things if we had decided take more money and put it to Batsonga, have some people around there putting a brick after a brick and so on. You would have the jobs. But the minute you actually do not actually go that route and you decide, rather, let me do a proper review of this and have a better understanding in the economic case and get it tested and make sure that the systems to get this rolling properly are in place, you will certainly have some consequences of that. So we will bear the consequences of that, but I am quite confident that in the coming year, we will far exceed all these targets by far, inclusive of what we would have actually planned for next year. And the reason for that is because the systems will be in place, the pipeline of the projects will be in place, and so on and so forth. So I'm really saying to the honorable members that it would have been unrealistic of ourselves to think that you would have things going well whilst you are fixing things that have gone horribly, horribly wrong. So that space that we're in will have a bit of impact on us in terms of those FTEs. But going forward, that space would have been cleared and the things would be in place and systems would be in place. So we would actually then be able to make sure that the delivery on these things is actually to the point and we are able to succeed in this regard. Thank you very much, Honorable Chairperson.
Thank you, DG. I see you are paving the way of FTEs in the next financial year so that we don't ask you why you did not achieve these jobs at this time. Honorable members, I've seen Honorable Adams, I've seen Honorable Foss, Honorable Tlaiko, Honorable Makubela Masele, are you all in? Okay, in that order.
I wanted to know who will go first, and I told him you mustn't go first, you mustn't go last, because then he'll make a speech.
Yeah, maybe let's allow Honorable Force to go last to sort of summarize.
Okay.
Is that okay? All right.
My notes.
Thank you.
I want to ask, the first question I want to ask is right at the end. Chairperson, that blue flag status, tourism projects, I see three provinces are involved. You named the Western Cape and the Eastern Cape and KwaZulu-Natal, but we have four provinces in South Africa. And I would like you to begin to think of the Northern Cape also. We have got wonderful weather during summer. Hot days and lovely cool evenings. You should really promote our province also. We follow the sun, not the crowds, and the people would like to go there. Thank you, Chair, for allowing me to do some commercializing here. Chairperson, on the projects currently under implementation, I'd like the DG to give us more information about the Craddock 4 Garden of Remembrance. What will it look like? And I see some of the projects are very costly. And I would like to know whether there are sister provinces, sister departments involved in this funding of the projects. And you know, Chairperson, I don't understand this really very good. It is an EPWP project, SRI EPWP project. EPWP, does it only pay for the labor? Does it pay for the establishment of the project? And I'd like the GTEC people to come in there and explain it to me. And explain what GTEC is. I have your document that the AG gave to the National Treasury, but I don't get a sense of exactly what you are doing and how you are going to assist this department. Then, Chairperson, on the risk and mitigation, I always preach to the committees where I am involved that they should have a closer look to risk and management. And it seems if they don't grasp what I'm saying, because if your risk and management section is very strong, you will be able to pick up earlier these mishappenings. And I want to know whether they have a risk and management committee outside of the department, because that is what municipalities do. They have a risk and management committee outside that looks from an outsider's view into what is happening, and they report to the management committee. I would like to know whether that is in place. Now, Chairperson, then on the forensic investigations, you know, for me, from 2010, and we are in 2016, I know the Justice Department is overloaded, but there must be some consequences, and there must be some reporting. You can't say we have so many cases. See, tell us. There are three cases, and this one is on that stage, and this one is on that stage. It's too vague. And say some disciplinary steps were taken. What kind of disciplinary steps? Were they in line with the mishap? Then, Chairperson, on the forensic investigations also, I'm on slide, I think it's 16. Inaccuracy reporting. You see, there is where the risk is coming already. If your risk section was stronger, they could have picked it up. These officials, I know they were perhaps in the provinces, and you see, that is where the thing of concurrency comes in. This liabilities, is it only the liability of National Department of Tourism, or do the provinces share these liabilities as these projects are in the provinces? Then, Chairperson, that is on the forensic. One is one of the engaged four projects. You say initially during 2010, a total of four projects were referred to for forensic investigations. That is what I want to know. What was the outcomes? How far is it? Then, Chairperson, on corrective measures, the services of Government Technical Advisory Center, GTEC, has been sourced in this regard. Now, DG, through the Chairperson, if the services is sourced in, who pays for the services? Because they are officials of National Treasury. Are they paid by National Treasury and by tourism? And Chairperson, the skills. Will GTEC leave some skills when they leave? Because they can't come forever here. Then, Chairperson, on that same corrective measures, engagement with provinces regarding sustainability support for projects that are ready for handover. You hand over the projects to the beneficiaries, and that is good. But you can't only say the provinces must support these projects. What about the municipalities? And Chairperson, I would like to know, if a project is hand over to the beneficiaries, asset management, asset register, who keeps an asset register of these projects that were handed over to beneficiaries? Because you know what happens. At the beginning, things are going well, and afterwards, it's dilapidating. Then, Chairperson, I would like to refer to the very beginning EPW funding criteria. Some of the criteria, I don't understand that EPW funding. You say a project must be identified based on their ability to generate a labor content of between 25% and 35% labor for the infrastructure projects and 40% and 60% for skills development projects. Now, I was very glad when I heard that the DG said some of the skills that were transferred to beneficiaries or to laborers, they were able to contract. Can you explain to me that? Is that when you have 100 rand, 35% of that 100 rand must go for labor? Explain that to me. And then the very next one, women, the target set for women is 55% and for youth is 55%. You know, I just count. 55 plus 55 is 110. Then the very last one. Chairperson, you say the EPW funding criteria, selected person must be provided with accredited training, the cost which may not exceed 5% of the project cost. Selected person, how do you go about selecting these persons? Because you know, we forever hear only some persons, certain persons get their jobs. And then, Chairperson, my very last one, I won't go further. You say there are challenges, program budget reduction in the MTEF. Can you give us a number? But not only a number, how will that influence your service delivery? Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, I would like to plead to do so that, such that you protect your children so that no one steals them during your time. Somebody tried to steal me from this committee just 30 minutes ago. Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Chair. Coming back to the presentation, let me first acknowledge the contribution of the department in job creation. 21,000 more is not a small thing because our people are not working. If I can tell you, share just a funny thing from my friend. One of my friends from Mpumalanga visited my own province there. He was so worried when he saw people convened for a meeting of 10 o'clock. And she asked a question, are people here not working? Why can't they be in a meeting at 10? It means in Mpumalanga they are working, they are not working there in the Eastern Cape. Chairperson, coming close to the presentation, I would like to take the department back to their funding criteria. I would like them to also consider the issue of land ownership. It must be there in their funding criteria, because there are those establishments that are built through land invasion. At least there must be something, even if it's a permission to occupy, there must be a document. It must be in their funding criteria that who owns the land, what makes that person to say, I own that particular land.
it will also be advisable for them to have, if they don't, engineers and building inspectors within, because there are buildings. If I can take you back to the project that is in Buffalo City, in Kiwane, it is reflected here as a project under planning. It is not, there are buildings there, but there was a problem. When we were doing oversight in the Eastern Cape, we visited that site, and there are buildings there. It is not under planning. Maybe it's a way of making an intervention. Coming to the issue of the establishments that are already there, but they are underutilized. Can I advise the department to... There's a project that was handed over by the department to Ndlambe local municipality. When we were there in that occasion, it was said that the municipality is going to invite interested business people to lease the property. My experience with those leases is that when that contract comes to an end, the people who have been utilizing the property will look at the loopholes of the contract and take the municipality to court. It means even after handover, we must also try to be closer. Is the establishment fully utilized? Who is there? Who are the initial owners of the property? So that there is value for money, because these are public funds. There are those projects that are said to be legacy projects from the former Department of... This is the same government. I want to come with a proposal that if there was whatever that was built by that department, you have taken over, try to focus those people around the project, even if it means donating the project to, so that it be utilized. It does not remain there as a white elephant. It must be utilized. You can see that we've long been showing interest in this SRI projects. When you come, we'll have some questions, posing some questions as a committee. Now you are here, and we appreciate that you have made this presentation. There are those, Chair, projects that... Okay, there are those projects that are from the previous, or I've said something about that one. What I wanted to stress is the issue of value for money, so that we are able to follow up in whatever that the department has funded. Thank you very much, Chairperson.
Thanks, Chairperson. Mine is just on two items only around the presentation. One is to appreciate the fact that some work is done around rehabilitation and making sure that the SRI projects get on board again and they start working for the intended purposes which were initially planned for. And to appreciate that the department has seen some of the challenges, because these were projects that were initiated and some went terribly wrong and some are actually shining stars. And we must appreciate the fact that those that are wrong, the department is doing something. I say this because in all the oversight visits that we went, in all the projects that have issues, the department is there trying to turn them around, which means there is light at the end of the tunnel and all is not lost. Because some of the projects, you know, it's one thing to speak here and think that all the projects could have been implemented and up and running. But when we went on oversight, we saw that there are serious challenges, you know, with communities, the way the projects were initiated, and there were bound to be some problems. And I must say, I commend the department for the strategies that they are using now to say the project implementers together with the Department of Treasury to come and see how best they assist those projects. Because some of them could be economic drivers amongst the communities. For an example, I would mention one project which is in Mpumalanga near the Kruger National Park. You know, the communities around there, some of them know how to do game drives. They know how to take around what you call tourists. They know the trails. You know, they are involved. It's just that they need assistance. And I'm happy that the department is really doing everything in their effort to assist those projects. And we would await the progress, Chairperson, because from what we've seen is that they are just not standing there, but some work is done around rehabilitation of the projects. And then but the question which I have is around the projects which were hijacked. There's one project which we went there, and I would say it was sort of hijacked because somebody just got in there and started utilizing the facilities, because those facilities were white elephants. And the facilities are good, but because, yeah, you could say somebody thought of something quite good, you know, because the project was a white elephant. It is a good project within a village, but somebody just hijacked that project and taken over and is using that project, you know, to their benefit, unlike the benefit of the communities. That example is sort of, I don't know whether it was supposed to be a lodge, it was supposed to be a cultural village, yeah, but it's there. There's somebody that went in, it was vandalized, somebody came in, renovated it, and is now using that establishment as a private establishment, and the proceeds are no longer going to the community or for the intended purposes. You know, I just don't know where are we going towards such projects, you know. And I'm specifically mentioning this because this is a case in point just in one project where we saw. It could be that throughout the country, some of the white elephants, somebody has got in there and is utilizing the state resources, our taxpayers, to their benefit and no longer to the benefit of the communities which the projects were intended. And I would maybe appreciate that in further reporting, we would also try to work around to see some of these projects which are now taken over by people who think we can use these projects to our benefit. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair. Let me comment or thank the presenter for presenting this document to us. On page 11, where we talk about, I think it's the last bulletin there, about the infrastructure projects, the percentage is 35 and 60, and also the one on page 6, which talks about 25 to 35. I don't know how to relate the two. Could you please clarify them again? And also talk to the issue where you are saying it is difficult for the SIR to plan projects properly so that at the end of the day they are finished on time and they don't need any extra funds. How are you going to go about budgeting for such projects? Because to me it seems it needs a lot of intensive planning or budgeting before a project can start.
take into consideration this intensive labor method that we want to use, and also completing the project that we have in mind. And so that when we start, we are sure that we are not going to end up with a project where it is not completed. A lot of money has been taken by the labor issues and so on, so that we are able to plan them properly. Somewhere also you talked about having engaged the external auditors. I just wanted to check as to whether you have your own internal audit committee to assist you in some of these areas. On all these projects that we have already indicated that failed, some of them they have stalled and so on, how much money have you lost? Have you done into that calculation to say we had so many of them, and then in that case, how much money have we lost in that particular situation? Okay. Then the other issue is on page 18. We are talking here of about 13 projects which were referred to forensic investigation. Out of how many projects, just want to have a feel of how many, well, what percentage of the projects failed and also referred to forensic investigation, just to have a feel of it. How many, it is 13 out of how many, so that you are able to talk about the percentage of those. Otherwise, I'm happy to realize that you are also committing yourself to say, come the coming year, things will not be like this. You shall have turned the whole thing around and there will be more progress. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Chair. Thank you very much. Chair, mine are very few, man. I believe that amongst your funding criteria is to ensure that whatever projects you undertake is co-funded by either the municipality or the provincial government. And also, there's undertake of the study to see the feasibility of that particular project. I think that's amongst your credit, including unlocking the tourism potential of the particular area. But I want to check now, you see, I want to check if I can just be taken into confidence, the adherence to your own funding criteria across all these projects. You see, because I'm raising this deliberately, I saw that you have touched on the issue of the participations of other spheres of government. But I would actually like a detailed participation, because it does not come into detail the participation of municipalities or provincial government in those areas where you have undertaken the projects. If I can just be taken into confidence in that. And then the other one that I want to raise is whether you as a department, you'll consider that in light of those projects that could not go through, or would you consider that those funding as wasteful expenditure? Because the reality, it means we did not get the value for money. And one would simply say that in terms of the PFMA, that is fruitless expenditure. But I want to check from yourselves if whether we can say that, we can say that that was fruitless expenditure. I also have the serious concern with regard to, because obviously if you are conducting a feasibility, you look at your own capacity, but I think it's coming very strong here that the department acknowledges lack of capacity, hence the point that is made by the previous member about the external auditor. To me, it's an expression of lack of capacity, because if you are to undertake an external auditor to do the work that you're supposed to be doing inside in terms of your internal auditing. It basically means you acknowledge that there's no capacity, you see. So if I can just be taken into consideration, because that to me ties to feasibility. Why would we engage into a project if we do have acknowledge the lack of capacity on undertaking that particular project? So if we can just be taken into that. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. I just wanted to pick up on the one point which Honourable Adams has also picked up, and that's the challenge that was presented to us with respect to the EPWP labour intensity benchmarks of 35% to 60%, which I think she interpreted correctly. As I read it, it was that's the amount that needs to be spent on labour. And I think the point that was made was that very difficult to do this in tourism when the projects are capital intensive. Now, we all know that unemployment in our country is a very, very serious problem. All parties actually acknowledge that. We may differ on how we want to address the problem, but we can all agree that there's 8.9 million people unemployed, and that is exacerbated because it's a cross-cutting cleavage with race. So it's a very, very difficult issue that we have to grapple with, and obviously a very sensitive one. However, I think we have to say that it seems to me that tourism, as presented us today in this report, is going to struggle to meet other mandates if they're trying to do mutually contradictory things. So we saw, Chairperson, as you'll remember, the very last project that we looked at in our oversight visit, the very last one in Mpumalanga. We saw a classic example of this. Yeah, the one with the big swimming pool, and we sat in the conference center. But mostly, all the important information we got at the gate when we had an informal discussion, and you remember. And I'm sure the committee members that were there will remember that once we started to interrogate the management, it turned out that the situation was far worse than what we originally thought, because they were including government grants as income, and therefore their losses, which were already quite big, if one took the total cost to the taxpayer, it was a multiple of 3 or 4 times that. So, I mean, as I remember, it was something over 20 million rand had been pumped into that, and they were still making a loss. We also then looked at some of the senior management and their wages, and there's a very large labor force running a resort with very few people actually attending it. So one can understand what the sentiments were and the good intentions to actually try and address the unemployment problem, which is as serious in Mpumalanga as it is anywhere else. But at the end of the day, we have a project which I think everybody from all parties recognized was unviable at that point and couldn't actually survive under its current management model. And that, I think, is a problem when you say, well, we want to try and actually tackle unemployment by having, essentially in that project, a feather-bedding exercise where the project can't stand on its own feet. And what I wanted to ask our presentation committee today is, would it not be better to have a different relationship with the EPWP constraints, and say it would be better to have 4 projects which were all at least breaking even, able to sustain themselves, and have people that are actually gainfully employed adding real value, than 1 project which is almost, without putting it too bluntly, is trying to mop up some of the unemployment in that area? Because it seems to me that if you can employ the same people in 4 viable projects rather than putting all of them in 1 which is unviable, over the longer term, the issue of sustainability is actually then addressed. And if one is not actually funding projects that are leaking money, like in the same way, for example, we have the challenge with SAA, then ultimately there is more money to generate further economic development. And I think, again, right across the political spectrum, I can't speak for people in other parties, but I sense from what I hear in the House that we would all like there to be many, many more small and micro and medium-sized enterprises that are all sustaining, that all contribute to the fiscus rather than actually take from the fiscus, and that unemployment is addressed, as I understood the President in his State of the Nation address, by a growing economy rather than the state trying to plug, you know, a bucket with lots of leaking holes. So I'd like to end off in pointing out that this is not a problem which is unique to us. This is a problem throughout world history. But if you look at the countries today that have the lowest unemployment, they're all capital intensive. And that's actually the truth. And it's actually allowing the market to determine prices and determine where funds flow. And the market, the money always chases opportunities and growth and increasing returns. And that in itself generates employment. So what I see here is a situation where we're putting the cart before the horse. And we know that tourism, as has been put here, it's a very good generator of jobs, but this type of project, as has been said in this presentation, is capital intensive. And so we seem to be doing two things that are mutually exclusive. And I'd just like your comment on that as to how we can find a model. And I know, so you're smiling because I'm putting you on the spot. And I know what you're going to say. It's not your sole mandate. And you're nodding again. But I'd like you to give to us as a tourism committee your take on how we could maybe approach this particular thing and how we could find a working model that also works for the sponsors of EPWP funding and most importantly works for tourism. Because at the moment, I don't think the model as you presented, and again, I understand, you have to be diplomatic, but is there not a better way to do it?
Let's go to our Crown Prince, Honorable Foss.
Now, most has been said already, Madam Chair, but I just want to ask maybe one or two questions to get in real terms, the amount of money that relates to the projects that have been put on hold or which have been stalled. My calculation is 178 million rand in that proximity, and then the number of projects I counted to be 14, if I can also just get clarity on that. Then, Madam Chair, the content advisors put together possible areas of interaction. And I've read through most of them, and I think they are very, very useful. So perhaps if we can, through the committee, send it through to the department and provide responses on these questions, because all of them are very, very relevant to this discussion. Some have been covered in the previous questions, but in the main, they really present good, useful questions that could provide absolute clarity and in some cases even direction. So to circumvent me putting it into parliamentary questions, maybe the committee through your office could present it to the department and they could then provide us with written responses. Madam Chair, obviously there's a combination of factors here at play. Some provincial governments and some municipal governments are to blame, etc., etc. But again, in the main, the money is available to execute this much-needed tourism infrastructure is made available to the Department of Tourism. So we must not shift the blame or do away with our responsibility in this regard. Although the implementers might be the provincial government or the municipal government in that particular jurisdiction, the point remains we must make sure that we have systems in place as a department to see these projects completed. That's the first thing. The second thing is to make sure that where we place these projects becomes the important point. My colleague mentioned the financial modeling and so on, but the feasibility studies, all those things are very important. Now, this brings me to the question about the almost 700 municipal holiday resorts that are either underutilized due to poor management, poor planning on the part of the municipality. Now, we've made this point previously that some municipalities do not have the capacity to manage many of these holiday resorts. And if there are about 700 of them in South Africa, clearly this is a project that could be linked to the revitalization of those municipal holiday resorts. because many of these resorts are located in places in our country which desperately needs a tourism boost. Some of these towns rely on the income generated from tourists visiting their towns, and therefore it also could form part of those small town revitalization project which is currently undertaken by SALGA. And I know that SALGA is one of our partners as part of the Tourism Toolkit project, and I think we need to link all of these things together. We've said previously that tourism is a cross-cutting responsibility. Many other departments need to play their part, and I think this is one of those projects that we shouldn't be undertaking alone. We need to work much closer with those other departments to see these projects implemented correctly. So let's not go and build infrastructure in locations that doesn't make business sense or where there's no demand, because tourism is one of those very unique sectors. You can't build something where there's nothing happening and expect people to suddenly go there. You have to do things that drives demand and that makes business sense. And if we have some of these holiday resorts that are currently underutilized or not in a good state due to the municipality's lack of capacity for whatever reasons, then this is a project clearly that should speak to that project, where we assist those underperforming municipalities to fix up those facilities and work with the network, with the tourism industry in that area to bring the necessary results. Because the DG did mention that in some projects it didn't make business sense to build some of these infrastructure in those places. And I think that is a way to deal with that issue again, so that we deal with a limited geographic spread issue. That's always one of the big obstacles that we are talking about, and also perhaps the affordability one, because many of these holiday resorts could now become part of that budget resort concept, where we can get South Africans to explore the different towns and provinces by utilizing this infrastructure that's already there, but by using these funds to actually just fix it and make sure that we provide also the soft skills. This is the last point I want to make. This is putting, I hate to say this, but it's sometimes a matter of throwing good money after bad, because we're fixing up most of these places. But yes, on the one hand, if we provide the hard skills, in other words, fixing stuff up, I think the soft skills need to come to train people to manage these places, so that you don't just build things, but that you also provide the skill to make it sustainable, so that these resorts and conferencing centers and chalets actually can become self-sustainable by providing people with the necessary skills and management tools to make a success of it. I think then we've actually sorted out our domestic tourism problem, the limited geographic spread problem, because let's use these funds much more wisely. Most of the budget that we get goes into marketing. This is our opportunity as a department to champion capital funds to leverage tourism infrastructure to drive demand. So, Madam Chair, just in closing, if I can just get clarity on the amounts and the number of projects and whether we could agree that this could form part of the department's written response. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much, honourable members. Those were very comprehensive questions. I've just got a few things to say. Does the department see any need for a PPP in these projects, so that when the project is completed, there is somebody to keep the project going until people, something like a mentor, until the people understand the various aspects of that business and how to run it? The other area that came sharply in our oversight visits was the location of projects. For instance, in Mpumalanga, in Bushbuck Ridge, they were located in areas where access is not so easy, where no tourist will ever go there if they were intended for tourist activities. No tourists will go to some of those areas at all. And the issue of feasibility studies and EIAs have been said, and I think it is important to look into that as well. And these projects do not actually put the tour operators somewhere on the agenda. if the project is somewhere in Bushbuck Ridge, what does the tourist, tour operator say to tourists? Where will the tour operator get the tourists from? And then, of course, the economic feasibility that has been spoken about quite lengthily. And you've got an institution that is actually doing a capacity to the staff of the department. And we hope that at a certain point in time, we'll be having capacitated members in the department. And actually, it's good you brought somebody from GTEC, because when we're looking at the presentation, we're saying, now there is somebody who is dealing with engineering or quality surveying or whatever, would like that person to come here to actually tell us what is it that is going to be done to change the way projects are being done. And finally, I think there is no communication in tourism. By saying so is because tourism is a competence for all the tiers of government. So if there was communication horizontally and vertically, I'm sure municipalities would buy in, provinces would buy in, national department would be also understanding what is going on in provinces and what is going on in municipalities, more so because tourism actually happens in municipalities. And that's where I think the attention must be focused one way or other, through communication. Because the money that the department delegates for projects is going to the municipalities. But on our oversight, we found that the municipalities are also just in a dwell, like us, we're coming to that place for the first time. And, yeah, and some of the structures, dear God, I can't begin to explain, but one wonders, what was the implementer thinking when this was put here? Thank you, Tichi. Over to you with your team. And I think your bringing this team here will have value for money for this particular presentation, because it's worrying us in the sense that we want people to get some jobs, and at times meaningful jobs, and we want tourism to prosper across the country. And Honorable Foss spoke very well about the budget resorts, because they're everywhere in the country, and I think it would be cheaper than other establishments. So I think the department needs tourism needs to communicate with each a sphere of government, or spheres of government must communicate. Thank you. Over to you, DG, and your team.
Honorable Chairperson and honorable members, thank you very much for the questions and, in some instances, inputs. I want to say, I'll give to the colleagues. They are going to come in, all of them, to give the details in the various areas. But I want to say, honorable Chairperson, that the beginning of healing is acceptance that one is not well, and that's what we have done. So the diagnosis has been done. We know what the problem is, and it helps that we know what we are fixing. So that's really the first thing. But we will go into the details. I will respond to the accounting questions. There's a few accounting questions. I'll respond to that. But perhaps what we should do is to start from the far end and come back all the way, unless if the lawyer, honorable chairperson, wants to start by just giving us the issues around the legal matters
and then we go to the other related issues. Thank you.
Thank you, TG. Thank you, Honorable Chairperson and Honorable Members. On the forensic investigations, just to put more details in terms of the two sets, we normally call it the two sets of investigation that the department had conducted. The first four, which were referred in 2010, were referred to the law enforcement agencies as a consequence of the recommendations that came from the forensic. We must say that the investigations brought to the fore quite critical information to the department about the SRI projects and their management. And again, a bonus was that clear recommendations were made in the forensic investigation reports. However, when we referred the matters to the law enforcement agencies, they also wanted to do their own investigation. And we also want to say that because the projects have been running for quite some time and had really accumulated a lot of documentation, the analysis of the documentation took quite a while. Implementers are required to keep documentation such as your bank statements so that we can verify the spending. But unfortunately, when they were requested to bring along or to hand over the financial documentation, they were not there. So the police had to go to extreme measures to find the documentation, like obtaining court orders against the bank for stemming from quite a number of years ago, for them to be able to analyze the movement of the project funds. The charges that were preferred were being investigated are fraud, theft, money laundering, and all associated or possible charges that could be brought against implementers. And again, for the law enforcement agencies to be able to prove these charges, they had to obtain a court order to go into the individual's bank accounts to be able to trace what would have happened with the project funds if there was loss, or in instances where the recommendations were such that money was not spent for the intended purpose. That process took quite a while. On the consequences, in terms of the PFMA, the accounting officer has to, forensics have been undertaken and investigations have been concluded, he's got a responsibility to ensure that the police are involved, a responsibility to ensure that where there's misconduct, action or disciplinary steps is taken, and also where there's loss for the department to ensure that there's a process to recover. Now, on all two sets of investigations, the 2010 one and the recent one, disciplinary processes have been completed. The DG alluded in his presentation that he was very frustrated that at the end of it all, the people who had been appointed to preside over the disciplinary cases came up with a verdict of a warning for officials. Now they were facing charges of inaccurate reporting and or failure to report in terms of the memorandum of agreement and their job descriptions. They are there at the provinces. They must make sure that they go on site, check and verify whatever reporting that the implementers are giving to the department, particularly with regards to progress or the statement, the status of a project. Now, in some instances, they simply will not be reporting accurately, or they do not report at all, which later then the department relies mainly on the report that comes from the project implementer, and that caused quite a huge frustration in terms of projects not moving in the manner that they should be moving. We were banking on the criminal investigation for more information, particularly on the movements of funds. When you issue summons, you must be able to quantify your claim. So we were banking heavily on the investigation by the law enforcement agency, so that once we know where has the money gone to, we will be able to say this is what the department can be able to claim. Now, that process having taken so long, we were at odds. That is why the decision that when we referred the matter to the Office of the State Attorney to recover, we instructed them to recover the total project fund. Now, it will depend on the people that we are suing for the funds to come back and say to us, this we have earned, so much we have earned, this is what we have bought. Of course, they should be able to produce invoices, they should be able to give us bank statements so that we can see whether they have earned or whether they have spent the money in the right places. The consultations have been done with the state attorneys. We now need to go and sort out the issue of a quantum as well. How much, where has the money gone to? We are hoping they will be able to provide answers in terms of how they have spent the money so that we are sure which amount must be returned back to the department. A case that maybe we can highlight that has gone to prosecution, though it has taken quite long due to the magnitude of the investigation, and also that the court rolls are normally very, you find in a year, the appearance was about 3 or 4 times, which became a postponement. At some stage, we were considering the department that we take this case to the area where the project was, so that people can see that we are really serious in taking action, because a lot of communities were affected. The project had to stop because it ran out of funds. So we wanted them to see justice being implemented. But then the prosecutors decided that it must come this side, because all of the people who were standing trial were this side in Gauteng. That case has gone very well. At some stage, the one of the accused person was trying to enter into a plea bargaining with the NPA. We are waiting for the NPA to formalize the plea bargaining and to send it to the DG for his consent. The other ones are still being investigated. We are very grateful that this one case that the NPA took to court, the investigating officer was quite sharp. He went to the scene, he went to court to get court orders to make sure that all the documentation is available and is properly analyzed. And we also are grateful that the investigative team was quite on board in terms of making sure that they identify clearly what the investigation officer of the law enforcement agency needed to go and look at. So, yes, we are keeping serious track of this matters that we have referred to the police and to the state attorney in the department. We are making sure that we learn quite a lot from what is being shared with us in terms of the investigation. The other thing is on the policy for the management of the of contracts. It also came from the forensic investigation. We were able to identify gaps in terms of what needs to be done. It will serve sort of as a standard operating procedures so that from the project manager on site up until in the department, the processing, what needs to be looked at, who must report breach. When you realize that the wall is not at the stage where it should be, what must a project manager do? How do you report, and ultimately at the financial side, what needs to happen for you to be able to sign off payment, which is quite what we are doing currently. And it has got consequences to make sure that there is improved reporting, particularly where things are not going as they should be going, and that together with the lawyers, with the finance people, action is taken quite on time to ensure that projects are managed in a manner that will be in the interest of the department. Thank you, Gigi.
Sorry, once you're at that, who is responsible for litigation payments? Is it the department? And if so, is that catered for in the budget of the department? Maybe the DG can answer that one. Thank you.
She does have money for litigation. But obviously, right till the end, then we have got to actually fight each of these cases with costs, because it can be that ultimately a person bargains or ends up going to jail or whatever it is, and we pay for the cost of that person. We will have to recover that as well.
An option to refer the matter to the Special Investigations Unit, which has been set up specifically to deal with maladministration, corruption, etc., where there's a financial loss to the state. That specific unit, would that not be an option to get them involved, seeing that there might be, there is financial losses to the state, and this particular unit is specifically tasked in terms of the presidential circular to deal with such cases?
Honorable Chairperson, we are acting on outcomes of a forensic audit. The forensic audit outcomes specifically gave us recommendations. The recommendations, one was that we should take the cases for criminal charges, and we should take this to the police, and the police must then act on these matters. That we have done, and that's why she is reporting on these particular cases. We should now, on the basis of what we have received as feedback from the NPA, follow through and make sure that, because they are saying they are not going to follow this particular route to prosecute, we now need to make sure that we go the civil route. And that is a determination that has already been done by NPA. So going back means we are going back to investigate whilst we have got results of an investigation. And going back to that investigation, the actions might again be saying, take this to the police. It will just keep, it's like a spiral, we'll go to and fro. So we're at a point now where we are saying, Honorable Chairperson, through yourself, Honorable Force, we are saying we are at a point where we have a go-ahead. We know that the prosecution authority are not going to be dealing with these cases, and they want us to go for the civil route. And that civil route, it is going to give us one of the two results. It's either we are going to get the result that says this particular business is going to pay back the money that it has owed us for a particular period of time. If we don't get that money from them,
then that particular business will have to go the route of actual blacklisting. But we are saying in the blacklisting, what we would like to see is the blacklisting of the individuals, because an individual can open another company tomorrow and still do business with government. So we're trying to get this as resolved as quickly as we can. If we go into that route, the likelihood of actually getting into the queue is also higher. Because they are dealing with cases. Here you are dealing with cases. I'll give you example. There are cases here. It's not all. It's a lot of money, because every cent of public money is money. But there are cases where you've got 2 million rands project, 3 million rands project. The one that I was talking about that I had already stopped was 9 million rands. So these are not the kind of cases that really they would put the kind of resource they have. So we took that into account when we got to the point where we say the best way to deal with this thing is a forensic that gives us the details, gives us indication of where to go. Once we have that, we should then be able to go and do what the forensic said, which we have done. But ultimately, at the end of all this, there has got to be some recourse, and that's why I was sharing with you some of the potential recourse that we're looking into. Thank you. GTEC.
Thanks, TG. Honorable Chairperson, honorable members. Maybe if I can just start by to answer two broad questions, kind of who GTEC is, how we work, and how we're going to support this initiative in working with the department. Firstly, I think to echo the DG, we've had various interactions with the minister and the DG himself. And they've recognized the challenges that many members have spoken about and the concerns. And that's on that basis they approached us to assist. Now, we have to do two things. We have to look at the current rollout of projects that are happening, and you can't stop. But we also, at the same time, want to review how we make this process more efficient and effective going forward. And from Treasury's perspective, I mean, value for money and improving efficiency and effectiveness are crucial. So let me say, start by how GTEC works. Basically, GTEC has been established under the Public Service Act through a government gazette proclamation as a government entity. So we report to the Minister of Finance. We receive voted funds from the Minister, from the fiscus. But our method of operating is that we have to work on a cost recovery basis. So we have a core set of staff. I'm a staff member. I'm a public servant. And I'm responsible for the client interaction with the department in this case, but also to contract in and bring in necessary resources that we can manage and oversee to ensure that they provide quality inputs to the work that we're doing. The difference, and I think where we add value, is that GTEC, because it's been around, it's not a private consultancy firm that comes in, writes a report, and disappears. We work very closely with the department. We determine what the needs are together. We agree the deliverables in a project charter. We have a joint steering committee that monitors the quality and the work and the output, and basically then ensures that the project delivers value for money, the interaction and engagement between GTEC and the department in this case. So just to say, and I think the DG, some of the slides have mentioned, we're doing two essential things. One is to look at long-term support to review the SRI. Is this the best model? How can we make it better? The comments from the honorable members around conflict of mandates. Can we have a capital-intensive project trying to meet EPWP targets? And that's a longer-term discussion we're having with the department. We're investigating that, and we hope to provide some very concrete proposals and recommendations to the department by the end of 2018. However, in the short term, we have these projects that are ongoing, that are stalled, that are in planning phase. And that we are putting a team in together as we speak, to hit the ground, to look at those projects in terms of feasibility, technical feasibility, but also the economic viability of those projects, and to make recommendations around these ones are good, needs these things to be in place, and we should continue and support to go forward, but also make the hard choice of saying these ones are just not viable. They're not practical, they're not going to work, and cut our losses and stop now. So that's the nature of interaction we're going to be working with the department going forward. And Chair, I think some of the options, looking at the long-term suggestion, I think that we have discussed, the options of PPPs and identifying the client ahead of time. Who's going to run this? Is it feasible? I think the DG said we're also going to be looking at those success stories. What were those issues? What was in place that made those projects successful? And how can we replicate it and improve it? And what are those factors that we need to address in those projects that have failed? So I think maybe just in summary, the department has been open with us. They've said they've got this challenge and they want assistance. Now, I think when you're trying to change the way a government program has been run, I think this was the question, you need an outside intervention. You can't let the staff and people that were involved in running it also think about how we're going to change it and do it differently. Yes, they have an important input to make, and we will be working with them and assessing their capability to run the program differently. So in terms of capacity building of the department, that's very much core to GTEC's approach and philosophy. We're not there as a private consultancy firm to come in, make a quick buck, do a report, and go on to the next project. We're part of government, we're in there for the long haul, and we're available to come to this committee or any other committee and account on our support that we provided to any department or entity of government. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you, Honourable Chair and Honourable Members. I'll respond to a few of the questions. Most have already been answered. And there was a question around the labour intensity, practically what it means, and the definition is correct. In a sense is that if a project, the total budget is about 100 rands, what it means is that 35 rands of that money must be set aside for the payment of wages of the workers that are employed in the project. That's what it means. So for the infrastructure projects, the percentage is up to 35%, and for the non-infrastructure, your skills development, the percentage is even higher, it's about 60%, the money that must be set aside for wages. And there was also a question around how do you select the people, the workers for accredited training, taking into account that 5% of the budget is earmarked for accredited training. Indeed, 5% is not enough to afford everyone who is employed in the project to be trained on accredited training. Then what we do, we do the skills audit of all the workers, and based on the outcome of the skills audit and also having pre-identified what skills are needed in the project, we then choose the people that will be able to cope with the higher level of training. But what is important to note is that all workers are trained in respect of non-accredited training to enable them to do the work that they have been employed to do. There was a question around the number of projects that have stalled. Yes, currently on our list is about 14 projects that we have provided. And I think the others were comments that were affected the balance between labor intensity and the mandate of the Department of Tourism. And,
I think part of the challenge, Honorable Force, is with the amounts, and I could hear she was about to go there and she stopped. We're not trying to hide anything whatsoever. The project would have one normal planning, and it relates to the question about what of this would, I think it was Honorable Khawula who said, what of this would then become, what was this wasteful or was it fruitless and so on. We're not at that point yet. And the reason for that, and I think that is partly what the treasury process would ascertain. The reason for that is because you've got wages that were paid. Those wages were paid, and the workers did some work on the site. So we're talking about these percentages, and in some of those instances, you would find that chunk that has actually gone to that, it has been spent, and it has been spent correctly on the EPWP wages, and everything else has been accounted for in that regard. You would also find instances of the planning money in terms of somebody has done an EIA, there is a record of decision and so on. So that whole accounting exercise needs to take place so that we are able to separate what would then be deemed this and not that. And in some of these, part of the reasons why I'm saying we're not there as yet, they would go inside, they would look at this thing. I'll give you one example where I don't know about the viability and so on, their economic viability exercise, what it would yield. Assume it yields positive. There's a site where a project was done, and there were floods, almost like what is happening currently now in Gauteng. It was in Limpopo. The foundations were swept off. And these were rains that came at a time where the predictability and so on and so forth was not factored in that space. The person went on and built, continued to build. And then this is basically replacement of the foundations with money that would have taken the person above the height of the windows. And then finishes this foundation and then come back and say, I don't have money. Yet what they should have done was simply to come to us and say, this is what we actually came across, this befell on us, and we are in a situation now, we don't have the money to replace, because the money that we have got, it is for the other part. We would have then signed off that money gets used properly, and after which then recalculate what then would be required for the other and continue with the project. Now, there was a bit of a time gap there, because we wanted to get engineers' reports to say, yes, did this thing actually happen in the manner that it is actually said. We wanted to get the weather reports, did this kind of event okay, and so on and so forth. After which then we ask, please go and do a recalculation of these things and tell us what then is required. When we interrogated that bill through the quantity surveyor that we've got in the department, The bill itself raised a whole host of questions. Typical example, there was a swimming pool that was actually costing us more than $1 million. A swimming pool. If that was signed off, so this is why we are doing this. And we said, we are not going to do that. So, no. A swimming pool. So what happened there was, We had to say, put a stop to this right now. Get it into that evaluation. Let's go through that evaluation. Let's get to a point where we can conclude on this matter properly. So it's issues like that. Does it mean the money spent on that project is actually, because I'm going to that point, does it mean that money is wasteful? It's not wasteful. So we have to actually apply the accounting principles to get to the determination, and we'll then be able to say here. So when we go back to that site and finish that project, it would have costed us more, but it doesn't mean there was wasteful expenditure on it. But there was, on the part of that implementer, a degree of maladministration, because it was a question of actually coming back to us and say, this is how things should actually take place. So that's why if we throw in a figure now and say, this is what it is, We probably would actually be giving a wrong figure, and I wouldn't want to do that in Parliament. Osmo.
Thank you very much, Chair. There was a question on by Honourable Adams on the blue flag. Why is the Northern Cape not part of the three? Because we have four coastal provinces. Unfortunately, for Northern Cape, the beaches, we're told they are not, can I say, not fit for people to bathe because of the cold Atlantic Sea. So we only have the three provinces that are participating in this program. And the number of FTEs that will derive from this will be 229. The other issue was, what will the CREDOC for project look like once completed? It is a visitor center with an amphitheater. And then upon completion, we'll have four pillars with brief biography of the four who were slain, represented by those pillars. And we'll also be dealing with an access road to the facility. Fortunately, this project is next to an information center that is run by the municipality. So there is that close interaction with the local government in that space. Are we sharing costs with the sister departments when it comes to this program? No. All the budget comes from the department. In kind, yes, they are, because they do participate in our project advisory committees, the municipalities as well as the province. On Ndlambe, Honorable Gregor is out. In the minutes, yes. On Ndlambe, it's one of those projects that is right at the seaside, also well, beautifully done. But in terms of the operations, the municipality being the owner, they said they'll lease this to an operator. It's true, we'll have to be closer to understand what's happening. Yesterday, we met with the Eastern Cape Department about these projects, and they said they'll go back to all of them and assess and see how can they assist them in terms of making sure that they become sustainable. We will also be closer in terms of ensuring that they help these projects. I think most of the questions were responded to. Thank you.
DG, before you come in, I think most of us are getting concerned in the fact that the Northern Cape has got the cold Atlantic Ocean. Mm. But that ocean extends our coastal line. So what innovative project or innovative whatever that can be developed along that route so as to promote tourism?
Jefferson, can I add that same cold Atlantic Ocean flows over to Walvis Bay and Swakopmund, and that two towns are flooded with tourists. A town like Port Nolloth, it's a beautiful, beautiful town. And some sort of tourism activity can be established there. The municipality has a resort there, but it's not well maintained. So if tourism can step in there, I know we have a Northern Cape tourism thing, and I think they do something, but with support from the National Department, much can be done, more can be done. Thank you, Jefferson.
There is a challenge for you, NDT. No place to hide.
No place to hide, NDT. we are in agreement. Lerato should have actually spoken to this a bit as well, because we are involved in the Oceans Economy Pakisa. And in that Oceans Economy Pakisa, there is a proposal for what they call in the Atlantic route. So that is our whole coastline throughout. And there's also issues pertaining to small harbors. So the Port Nolloth and so on. So there is. We are also in the Northern Cape, but it's gonna take form and shape properly as we start rolling out the Pakisa. Lerato, do you want to say something? And the municipal resorts there, actually not just municipal, government owned resort, because a typical example, Honorable Chairperson, because we'll have to do some sort of a pilot of how best do we engage this with the EPW methodology. Now, if you look at KZN as an example, Ezonvel owns products across the entire province, from the northern Drakensberg all the way to the Didima side, all the way to Umfolozi, all the way to, even inside Ismangaliso Wetlands Park. And even when you go down South Coast, they own products there. So in all those reserves, you actually find something. You go to Midma, they own products there, and so on. So all these places, when you look at that, you then ask yourself, who owns this? It's actually owned by Ezonvelo. Ezonvelo is actually the province. So there is that dimension that we also have to look at. So it's that study includes both some municipal, some provinces. You go to Gauteng, Sekerbos is owned by the province. So it's those types of issues. But we want to make sure that as we look at this thing and the sustainability and so on, we have all the pieces together. And then we'll be able to approach it. Lerato.
Thank you, DJ. The Northern Cape, in terms of the Oceans Economy Pakisa, it's a province that needs quite a lot of intervention and support if you compare it to the other coastal destinations. And that became clear when we were doing the Coastal and Marine Tourism Lab. And the province has taken this to the fore. They have recently developed a coastal and marine tourism strategy. I think they are finalizing it. And in that strategy, they have identified areas along the coastline with potential to be developed further, areas to be marketed, and the products to be packaged together. And concerning the Blue Flag program, the three provinces are a start, and the intention is to roll out the intervention and cover other areas. And hopefully in the future, the Northern Cape will also benefit from the Blue Flag program, but it was just a start. But with the interventions through the Oceans Economy Pakisa, we will be able then in the future to cover some of the beaches in the Northern Cape. Thank you.
So, Honorable Chairperson and Honorable Members, the truth is the water in the Northern Cape does complement the weather in the Northern Cape. There are some few other questions that I would like to also provide honourable members with some information on internal versus external auditors. We do have sufficient internal audit capacity. They have a very robust internal audit plan. Some of it does touch on elements pertaining to this, for instance, observation of specification committees and all those kind of things. They do quite a thorough work. But when you're doing specialized things like this, almost like what Ishmael was saying, you do need a little bit of a distance. Because this is the same... And you are not going to be able, most of the time, you won't be able to keep that resource consistently inside to wait for a certain period from time to time. So there will be instances where we'll have to insource. This is one of those instances. They do their work, they finish their work, they give us the product, they get out. And that gets integrated into how then our internal auditors track how we are doing in terms of those kind of things that would have actually been found. The other issue is pertaining to projects that are already handed over. Those projects present huge challenge, particularly the projects that were handed over prior to the split of the department. This would be projects, for instance, something done in 2001, and it's handed over. And the particular community decided their contract says it's theirs. They decided what to do with it. And subsequently, it's impossible to go back to them and say, can we relook at the thing that we've given to you? Can we discuss it? Others are working well. In some instances, this would then relate to Honorable Makubela said is it could amount to hijacking. It is true, it could amount to that, but sometimes it's the hijacked is willing, if I could put it in that way. And the contractual agreement that is in place, there is no third party that becomes us. It is that particular community leadership that said, we want this person to actually run with this. And they've agreed on their own terms and so on. So what I can say to Honorable Chairperson and Honorable Members, what I can say to the Portfolio Committee is that going forward, those are things we are dealing with. Yesterday, I was signing the contract for the one that is going to the Saturday one, Komjekejeke. And in there, there's an indication that this is not for sale. It's not for personal benefit and so on. So this, we are bringing in these issues in the issues of making sure that this is kept, maintained, and so on. And all those issues, then we are bringing them up. These are lessons that we have picked up as we are going through these things, and now we have got to make sure that we factor this in. Do we have a risk management committee? Yes, we do. We have got a risk management committee that is independently chaired by someone who is a risk management professional and totally independent. I get reports from the chief risk officer on the workings of this, and then I've got my own scheduled meetings with the chairperson, who is able to raise with me what are the challenges that they are seeing and so on and so forth. And we regularly update our risk register and act on it. The 55-55, so it would be 55% woman, but that woman would still be a youth. I think, Honorable Chairperson, the matters that were raised by Honorable Krumbuk are pretty much some of the things that we are saying to ourselves in this review. Let us look at aligning the business case for tourism with aligning the money with the business case for tourism. So ultimately, this is why I've been saying quite a lot about experience and destination enhancement. There are places where just being able to go to God's window and that path where people are going to get to and actually see that those are things that have to be done. They can only be done by government. So there are those dynamics. And getting that balance together with the other aspect which says, in light of the fact that you've got this challenge and you've got money that is actually dwindling, how are you going to make sure that you still sustain going forward? The truth of the matter is that we can't walk away from commitments we've done to communities. Unless if there is no justifiable case, we cannot force the case in that community. But where there is a just case, we have got to finish what we started. So we have got to clear that whole backlog. So they will review and they will say, this, you must proceed. It means we have got to make provision for that specific one. Of course, there will be issues, other issues that would apply. If they are saying proceed with this thing, but we look at it and it says it's 110 million or 120 million, and we do not have that money, we'll have to get into different discussions with such communities. So it's going to be a bit of a difficult period going ahead for us, but it comes with a job. We'll have to face those realities. But in the main, we are committed in making sure that those communities are not unduly disadvantaged ultimately because of this particular problem. Thank you very much, Chairperson and Honourable Members.
Are we getting anything from policy and knowledge?
The policy and knowledge, Honourable Chairperson, is designing the future of this program. So they are listening to the inputs that you are bringing. But you might want to say something because otherwise we might run into fruitless expenditure issues. Shamila.
I think my brief input actually relates to the inputs that Honourable Member Krumbok has actually made around capital intensivity. And I think that that's one of the things that we are going to look at in the redesign of the program, how we still actually achieve investment in tourism infrastructure, but still in compliance with the EPWP model, so creating the jobs, and how we actually customize the current program to focus on providing tourism infrastructure but not being restricted in the same way that we currently are because we're part of the cluster that deals with the environment. So that's my very short, sweet input.
Honourable members, I think we thank the department for the presentation, and the department is excused. There are just a few matters for us as committee to deal with. One is we are not dealing with minutes today. I think we'll set a dedicated hour or day to deal with the minutes, all the minutes, because we've been pressed for time and not being able to do the minutes. The second issue is we met as the chairpersons of committees that did an oversight visit in KZN. Tourism has looked into that report and has made its input and adopted, but the other committees have not. So they will be doing it before we close, and it has got to go to the ATC before we close so that it becomes a public document. So that's the information I share with the committee today. But thank you very much for the very active participation of all the members. Thank you very much. The committee is adjourned. The meeting, is adjourned. Thank you. And we look into the